Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. All Alice Stahl wanted was a day of rest. She had an awful cold and a 103-degree fever. Her husband, Barry, had left her in the morning in the home they shared in Louisville, Kentucky. The home had a name, which I share as evidence that the Stahls were from a wealthy family. The house was called The Cottage, capital T, capital C. It sat just off Lime Kiln Lane on a 16-acre estate in an isolated, hilly, wooded parcel in the Harrods Creek area. Now, when I think of a cottage, lowercase c, I usually picture something modest. The Cottage was, by my standards anyway, a straight-up house. It was 1,900 square feet with two bedrooms on the second floor and a spare room on the first floor that the family could use as an office or a third bedroom. It was awfully nice by normal income standards, but it was also the most modest of several properties owned by the Stahl family. See, Barry Stahl was an executive at the Stahl Oil Refining Company. There's two Stahls in that sentence because the company's founder, Charles Christian Stahl, better known as C.C. Stahl, was Barry's father. C.C. launched the company in 1911. Back then, it was just the Stahl Oil Co., no refining in the title, and it sold almost 100 petroleum products, things like transmission oil, gear lubricant, that kind of sexy stuff. The refining was added to the name in 1918. Speaking of names, just quickly I'll mention that the surname here is spelled S-T-O-L-L, which looks like stole, but as author William Plunkett explained,
they pronounce it Stahl down in Louisville.
Anyway, Alice Speed had married into a wealthy family, but hers was quite well off too. In fact, the Speeds were one of the wealthiest and most well-known families in all of Louisville. That's according to Plunkett, who wrote a book about this case called The G-Men and the Heiress. Alice's parents, William and Virginia, provided their daughter a cushy upbringing as she came of age after World War I. By the time Alice married Barry in 1927, she was a jazz-loving, car-driving, beer-drinking woman with the bobbed hairstyle of a flapper, though she wasn't nearly as defiant as one. In fact, Mother Virginia had been a bit overbearing, and Alice had grown up privileged but sheltered. She hadn't been allowed out after dark. She wasn't allowed to walk to the local corner store alone. Her mother constantly warned her about predators abound. So it seemed almost preordained that on October 10th, 1934, as Alice nursed a cold at home, a predator came calling. Aside from the illness, the day was a typical one in the cottage. Husband Barry had left about 8:30 a.m. for work. It was a Wednesday, so the home's caretaker, Fowler Woollett, had the day off. The laundress had already come and gone by early afternoon. Alice still wasn't alone, though, because a part-time helper named Frank Hardin was there to work on the farm, and a maid was there, too. Her name was Ann Woollett. She happened to be the caretaker's wife. The couple had worked for the Stahls for 2 years and lived in the home's basement. There happened to have been problems with the telephone service in the area, and early in the morning, a repairman with Southern Bell Telephone Company had changed out phones in the cottage for new ones. Despite her illness, Alice had helped him test the phones, which were working fine by the time he left at 9:30 a.m. After he left, Alice curled up into bed, ready to rest the remainder of the day. But then came another knock. Ann Woollett answered the door and found a man saying he was with the phone company and needed to check the phones again. This didn't seem far-fetched, though his attire stood out a bit.
He was wearing a gray pinstripe suit, I think a white shirt, blue tie, and he had a gray fedora hat on. And so she thought it was odd that he was well-dressed and he had a little Southern drawl.
Still, Ann didn't think much of it. She let the man in. He checked the downstairs phone and the phone connection box in the basement. Then he said he needed to check the upstairs phone. It was in Alice Stahl's room where she was resting, so Alice moved to a spare bedroom so he could work, and the next thing she knew, the phone repairman walked in with her maid and a .45 caliber pistol. Alice asked, "What are you here for?" The man replied, "I am here to kidnap you." Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. You know, sometimes I need therapy.
Who doesn't?
Right? I've been extra stressed the past, 6 weeks. And the therapists I've Googled locally are booked up for months and cost a ton to boot. Sometimes you just need easy access to affordable therapy.
Rula offers that. Rula's on a mission to make high-quality mental health care from a licensed professional easy and affordable for everyone.
Yep, Rula's got you covered. They take most major insurance plans, and the average copay is only $15 per session.
Rula isn't just affordable. They stick with you throughout your journey, making sure you get the best therapy and that you're making progress.
Rula starts by asking a few questions about what's important to you and then provides a list of licensed in-network providers who match your preferences. I'm checking them out this week.
Go to rula.com/COTC to get started today. That's rula.com/COTC for convenient therapy that's covered by insurance.
Thousands have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. Head on over to rula.com/COTC to get started today. After you sign up, they ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them our show sent you. Go to rula.com/COTC and take the first step toward better mental health today. You deserve quality care from someone who cares. For a 28-year-old woman who had been sheltered much of her life, Alice Stahl stayed impressively stoic while staring down a strange man with a gun. First, she calmly offered him money, though that ended up being a ludicrous offer.
She only had $10 in cash, so she tried to pay him with that and then tried to write him a check. That didn't work.
Because of course it didn't.
Next, he was going to tie her up and he laid the gun down on the bed and she went to grab it and he hit her twice on the head.
The wax to Alice's head caused a laceration and head injuries bleed horribly, so a concerning amount of blood got on the bedding in the spare bedroom. "You're killing me," Alice said matter-of-factly. She was effectively subdued. The kidnapper forced the maid to help tie Alice up and put tape over her mouth. Then he tied up Anne by himself, winding wire around both her wrists and her ankles. Then he went and grabbed Alice Stahl a coat. Because she had planned to spend the day in bed, she was wearing only a kimono, so he grabbed her something more substantial to wear, which was maybe nice. Hard to give him much credit for that. Plus, his choice of outerwear was odd because it was a warm October day, hitting about 70 degrees, and the wool coat he had grabbed was far heavier than was needed for the weather. It seemed maybe he was planning on keeping Alice for more than just a brief stay. Next, he led Alice, who had slipped on some high-heel shoes, to his car. She went willingly because, she said later, her husband was set to come home at any moment, and she worried that this wild man with a gun might hurt Barry. She loved Barry. She didn't want him hurt. So rather than fight any further, she climbed into the back of the kidnapper's car without a struggle. He covered her with newspapers and a blanket, and off they drove. Meanwhile, back at the cottage, the maid managed to get her ankles free. She didn't have as much luck with her wrists, though, so she tottered to one of the telephones to call for help, but the kidnapper had disconnected the newly fixed phone line. So Anne stayed upstairs and watched out a window for Barry Stahl to come home. It didn't take long. Barry arrived, heard the maid's screams coming from the upstairs bedroom, and rushed to help. Finding blood spattered on the bed, he quickly realized how serious the situation was. He was frantic enough that at first he didn't notice the ransom note that had been left rather prominently for him. Once he did, he found it to be odd.
The ransom note that he left was like 2 pages long. Normally somebody would say, I've kidnapped so-and-so, I want $50,000. Well, his was a 2-page typewritten letter.
Portions of it had been crossed out and revised. Apparently, the kidnapper initially wanted $30,000, but he had struck that out and changed it to $50,000 instead. The note also originally said he had kidnapped Cece Stoll. Now it said Alice Stoll. It was clear Alice hadn't been his first target that day, which was interesting because, truth be told, Alice's in-laws were actually worth less than her birth family, and yet it was clear he'd been more interested in the Stahls. The letter eventually said why. Cece Stahl was miserly, refusing to repaint his filling stations. It seemed a weird motive. The kidnapper wanted half of the ransom delivered in $10 and $20 bills. He didn't specify what denominations the other half should be. He warned that the Stahls shouldn't copy the serial numbers of the money, and they shouldn't contact the police or media either. Of course, Barry immediately contacted the police, which soon swarmed the residence and questioned the maid. She described the kidnapper as thoroughly as she could remember, though it would turn out that she got a few details wrong. She said he was maybe 5'9". He actually was 6 feet tall and very thin at about 130 pounds. He sounded well-educated, she said, and strangely well-dressed, which she recognized in hindsight should have been a red flag. He had a pale face, thick red lips, and black, slick-down hair. The maid and her husband, both employees, were immediately suspects in the kidnapping. But after multiple interrogations by the Division of Investigation, which would not long after be renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigations, they were determined to have taken no part in the crime. Nevertheless, Barry Stahl would fire them a few days later. Meanwhile, federal agents analyzed the language in the ransom letter and noted that it was written using the word we a lot, as in there were either multiple kidnappers involved or a lone kidnapper wanted authorities to think there were. It also used phrases like corpus delicti and aggravate our offense, which agents took to mean the writer had a familiarity with law enforcement terms. They pulled together a sort of profile on who they thought they might be dealing with. He seemed educated, as the maid had suggested, probably having worked some white-collar jobs. He was clearly a bit erratic and audacious. Surely there were less dangerous ways to get $50,000 than to kidnap a woman from 2 high-profile families. The ransom letter was dusted for prints, as were some other items from the house. A roll of tape, a screwdriver, a table knife. But the only things that had usable prints were the envelope and one of the telephone boxes in the house. Now, figuring out the who in this whodunit turned out to be exceedingly, laughably easy, though, because the ransom letter spelled out who the ransom intermediary would be. It listed Thomas H. Robinson Sr., a Nashville engineer and bridge builder. He was largely considered a stand-up fellow, though he was known to drink too much and frequent sex workers, despite being married to someone who'd really rather he didn't. But that's not who agents zeroed in on. Rather, they looked to Robinson's son, Thomas Robinson Jr. He was the only one in the family with a criminal record. He had previously worked for the Stahl Oil Company. And most importantly, the fingerprints found at the scene were a perfect match. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Ollie. If our dogs could talk, they would beg us for Ollie, and it'd get real annoying. But you know what? I'd understand, wouldn't you, Scott?
Yep, Ripley and Ellis love Ollie, and why wouldn't they? Ollie is clean, fresh nutrition for your dog.
A perfectly portioned, whole, fresh food diet has been proven to extend your pup's life by 2.5 years.
Who doesn't want more time with their best friends?
So here's how this works. You fill out Ollie's 30-second quiz, and they'll create a customized meal plan based on your pup's weight, activity level, and other health info.
Ollie crunches the numbers and recommends the right recipes and daily portions for your precious pup based on hundreds of thousands of real dog results. And these are results you can see. More excitement at mealtime, shinier coat, and solid, easy-to-pick-up poops.
Ollie offers 3 meal plans to choose from, so you can choose between a full fresh plan, fresh topper plan, or a mixed plan with their freshly baked recipes for your special fur baby.
They also have treats and supplements.
Dogs deserve the best. And that means fresh, healthy food. Head to Ollie.com/COTC, tell them all about your dog, and use code COTC to get 60% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today. Plus, they offer a happiness guarantee on the first box, so if you're not completely satisfied, you'll get your money back.
That's OLLIE.com/COTC and enter code COTC to get 60% off your first box.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Thomas Henry Robinson Jr. was a year younger than Ellis Stahl. Thomas was born in 1907 in Nashville to his dad, the engineer and contractor, and mom, Jessie Lois Preston, originally from Zanesville, Ohio. Thomas Jr. was the couple's only son. His dad, despite his flaws, truly was a self-made man, having been orphaned at just 5 years old. He paid his way through school by selling newspapers, then became a professional baseball player, boxer, and gymnast. Plunkett writes that Thomas Sr. got a civil engineering degree through correspondence and night class. In his mid-40s, which I dare say was older back in the 1920s than it is in the 2020s, he took YMCA law school correspondence classes, which Plunkett suggests might be what prompted Thomas Jr. to later study law himself. Long before that, though, Junior was
a sickly kid, had mumps, measles, chicken pox. But then he ended up getting tuberculosis and was put in a sanitarium, they called him then, a hospital.
It's a good thing we have vaccines for all of those ailments nowadays. But health issues weren't Thomas Junior's only problem.
He was troubled in school. The kids thought he was kind of arrogant and a know-it-all. He joined the Boy Scouts and there was an issue there and they had a tribunal about whatever infraction he did and he called it a kangaroo court. He got kicked out of some schools. Some other pulled strings to get him in this other school and he was in charge of the newspaper or magazine and he stole the money for the subscriptions.
But hey, he did really well in Latin, so there's that. His parents both shielded and spoiled him. He got a Buick coupe on his 16th birthday in an era when, and I remember this from my Leopold and Loeb research, season 1, episode 2, less than 15% of the population had a car. It cost about $800, which translates to nearly $15,000 today. He hadn't had many friends before his car, but after he got it, he was suddenly much more popular. By the time he enrolled in Vanderbilt University, he was considered a playboy, which led to more health problems, this time of the STI variety. He was treated for gonorrhea first, and then later for syphilis. While in his first year of college, he met a girl named Sue Ann Tubbs, who was still in high school. They didn't stay together long, at least not initially. They just had a few dates. She reappeared a short time later, though, pregnant with his daughter.
There was a shotgun wedding, went down to City Hall, ended up getting married, but he never lived with her.
See, his parents didn't like Sue Ann, thought she was too lowbrow for their perfect boy. Thomas Jr. tried to get the marriage annulled, but naturally couldn't. Not with a child in the mix, though he tried to argue the baby wasn't his. That didn't convince a judge, because Sue Ann insisted Thomas Jr. had been her only lover. He divorced Sue Ann in 1928 after 14 months of marriage. He had apparently only met his child once. But
she said there were anonymous gifts sent to the child, and she thought it was from Robinson. And she also thought that he wanted to come and visit her, but his parents wouldn't let him.
It's hard to say if that's true or not. What is true is that after the divorce, Thomas Jr. met another young woman named Frances Althauser, and she would play a major role in Alice Stahl's kidnapping just a few years later. He was not an ideal husband, and that's putting it mildly. He once shot Frances in the leg, though both parties told police it was an accident. Sure, he'd been mad when he'd pulled out the gun, but it only went off when he dropped it. He hadn't meant to shoot his wife. She stayed with him, and things got worse. He couldn't hold down a job. He started drinking. The couple moved in with his parents, who didn't seem to like Frances much more than they had liked Sue Ann. They didn't like her smoking or dancing or the high-heel shoes she wore in the house. But they didn't seem to take issue with Thomas Jr., not even when he was arrested impersonating a deputy sheriff with a fake badge, or when he stole diamonds, watches, and rings from three wealthy women in Nashville, nor when he stole $3,000 worth of valuables from another lady's home. He was arrested but didn't get jail time after Thomas Sr. promised to return the stolen goods and pay restitution. His son pleaded insanity to one of the robberies and was evaluated by a train of doctors who said he displayed delusions of grandeur. He stayed for nearly a year in an asylum before he was released in May 1930, determined to be, quote, improved but still insane, end quote. He was back in a different mental hospital just 5 days later. Despite doctors there deeming him a menace to society and psychopathic, Thomas Jr.'s family sprung him from that hospital. He worked some odd jobs for a few months until he landed at the Stahl Oil Refining Company in Louisville. He got the gig because his father was friends with C.C. Stahl. Thomas Jr. earned $65 a month pumping gas every other day, while on alternating days selling gasoline and fuel oil and whatnot. He left that gig and worked a few others. Insurance salesman, student recruiter, handyman, oil burner salesman, never lasting for long. Sometimes he would leave the jobs of his own accord, looking for higher pay. Other times he was let go when company bigwigs learned he had a criminal record. In April of 1934, he was back to his old law-breaking ways, attacking young women as he robbed them. He was arrested in April, but once again escaped any real punishment. Which meant that when the urge to commit kidnapping in October 1934 hit him, nothing was stopping him.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Kidnappings for ransom were the crime du jour in the 1920s. We've talked about some of the high-profile cases before, particularly in the Barker and Karpis gang episode, Season 1, Episode 5. A lot of it was tied to the rise in organized crime that was an unintended side effect of Prohibition, which began in 1920. But not all of it was tied to organized crime. Some cases, like the Marion Parker kidnapping turned murder in 1927, involved petty criminals who decided that everything in their lives would be peachy keen if they could just get one mighty score by way of a ransom. They didn't seem to notice that most of these kidnapping cases ended in either tragedy for the victim or arrest of the culprit. After Thomas Robinson Jr. loaded Alice Stahl into a stolen black 1934 Ford V8.
He took Alice to Indianapolis. That's where he had a hideout apartment. He was living there for a while under a fictitious name.
It would seem his wife Frances had at least stayed there a while too, because eventually Alice was given one of Frances's dresses to change into. When they arrived though, the apartment was a mess, like a typical bachelor pad. And Alice could plainly see where a captor might have gotten the idea for his kidnapping plan. Pulp magazines were strewn about the place.
They're like fictionalized, dramatized stories about crime and salacious stories of the day.
The Lindbergh baby kidnapping was major fodder for these magazines. And sure, the kidnapper got away with $50,000, but Bruno Hauptmann had just been arrested the month before Robinson kidnapped Stahl. That surely was in the very pulp magazines he had in his hideout apartment. And yet, that was not a deterrent for him. Life inside the apartment must have been mighty surreal for Alice. The place had two beds, so they slept apart, she wearing her heavy wool coat for warmth.
When they'd go to sleep at night, he would tie her hands to the bed springs.
Sometimes Alice would cook, apparently out of boredom or maybe to feel in control of something. When Robinson Jr. would leave the apartment, he would tie her to a wooden chair and put her in a narrow, coffin-esque closet where she'd be left sometimes for hours. When he stayed in,
they would talk about the newspapers because he would get those, and he was worried that they kept reporting all these things that weren't true. And she'd tell him, well, that's a good thing. If they're reporting things that aren't true, that means they don't know where you are and they're not going to find you.
Imagine having to reassure your kidnapper that, don't worry, you're going to get away with this. And Alice had to do even more than that because Robinson seemed unfocused. He would sleep past noon some days and just seemed listless. It was Alice who prodded him to make the phone calls, write the letters, get this ransom thing done so she could get back home. The first time Thomas Jr. reached out to an intermediary, it wasn't his father, as his letter had said it would be. It was actually a phone call to the home of his father-in-law, Nathaniel Althauser. Frances was staying there and answered the phone. Robinson identified himself using one of his known aliases, John A. Ward, and said he was Mrs. Stahl's kidnapper and that Frances could expect Alice's wedding ring and a letter in the mail to show he was telling the truth and that Alice was alive and well. By this point, law enforcement already knew to have operators listening to phone calls made to the Robinson family or the Althausers. J. Edgar Hoover had been head of the federal agency that would become the FBI since 1924, so he wasn't new on the job, but he was still in the early stages of transforming the department into something far more powerful than it had ever been before. He was also a major source for those pulp magazines. He loved the national reputation his G-men were getting as sharpshooting do-gooders who always got their man. Or, in the case of Ma Barker and Bonnie Parker, their woman. The operator relayed to the feds that the call had originated from Hook's drugstore on North Illinois Street in Indianapolis. Agents arrived as soon as they could, but of course the caller was long gone. Pictures of Robinson in hand, they canvassed area businesses hoping to spot him without luck. Hoover enlisted the phone company's help in not just monitoring calls to Robinson and Stahl's relatives, but all calls originating from Indianapolis and going out to either Louisville or Nashville. The Stahls and Speeds were terrified, of course. They'd heard from the feds that the kidnapper claimed Alice was still alive, but they had no proof of it. And Barry couldn't get the vision of that blood-stained bed out of his mind. He searched ditches near the house, looking for signs of his wife's body. Alice's father, William Speed, wasted no time in gathering the ransom money. On October 11th, the day after the kidnapping, he pulled together $50,000, mostly in denominations of fives, tens, and twenties. The feds and the bank workers attempted to jot down the serial numbers of the bills, but they did it wrong. They wouldn't figure this out until much later, but they would have no way to track the bills as they were spent after the drop-off. Thomas Jr. seemed paralyzed by fears of getting caught. He refused to call the speeds or the stalls directly, which worried Alice, who feared she'd never get home at this rate. So she proposed that he call a friend of hers that was peripheral enough that surely no one would have thought to monitor her phones. So he called Elizabeth McHenry and pretended to be a guy strong-armed by the kidnapper to reach out and ask McHenry to tell the stalls that Alice was indeed still alive and that they needed to shake the feds long enough to allow an intermediary to collect the ransom money and deliver it to him. Letters soon arrived at Robinson Sr.'s house, one from the kidnapper, who was still pretending not to be Robinson Jr., and another from Alice, which was enclosed with her wedding ring. She said she was being treated well, outside of the cut on her head, and that the $50,000 in ransom money was to be turned over to Francis Robinson, who would receive further instructions. The Stalls and Speeds played ball, packing $50,000 into a package that ultimately weighed 7 pounds. Feds had planned to tail Francis as she hauled that money in a suitcase to the drop-off location, but she quickly lost them, Plunkett explains.
She took a train from Nashville to Indiana, and the FBI is following her, but she eludes them, loses them, gets in a cab, switches cabs, gets breakfast, eventually shows up at the apartment, throws the package wrapped in brown paper with all the money. She was a nervous wreck during the whole thing because agents would use the word hysterical, you know, while she was doing all this traveling.
When she finally arrived at the Indianapolis apartment, she had come unraveled. Apparently, the plan had been for her to flee with her husband, but along the route, she changed her mind. When he left, it was with the understanding that the two would never see each other again, for he would be a man on the run, and she would forever be under surveillance by Hoover's agents. When Robinson left the two women in the apartment, he instructed them to wait a full 24 hours before leaving to give him a healthy start on his getaway, but neither was interested in that. Francis felt bad for Alice, who was desperate to get home. Once they felt certain Robinson was on his way, they left that dingy apartment and never looked back. Alice remembered that she had a cousin by marriage who lived in the area, so the women found the address for the Reverend Eugene Arnold Clegg and his wife Irene. They also called Elizabeth McHenry and told her to tell Barry Stahl that his wife would be returning yet that evening. I assume they didn't call Barry directly because they were trying to keep the arrival on the down low, but if so, that didn't work because, remember, the feds had telephone operators listening in, so they alerted agents who aimed to intercept Alice on the off chance that her kidnapper would be accompanying her home. Then Alice and Francis made their way to the Clegg residence. Here's the Reverend speaking to reporters about what happened next.
Tuesday afternoon, about 3 o'clock, while making a pastoral call, I received a telephone message from Mrs. Clegg to come home as soon as possible. Upon arriving, I was greatly surprised when informed by her that our cousin, Alice Stahl, the kidnapped victim, and a lady companion were there. A short while before...
That night, Alice Stahl was reunited with her husband, and a nationwide manhunt was underway for her kidnapper.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
He had no way of knowing it at the time, but Thomas Robinson Jr. was way ahead of the feds and, had he played his cards right, could have easily disappeared with the ransom money for good. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover wasn't about to let the public know that the bank had botched a lot of the investigation already. They hadn't correctly documented the ransom money serial numbers, and they'd lost track of Frances as she'd made her way to the kidnapper's apartment. Not only that, but the Indianapolis apartment where Alice had been kept was just down the street from a federal agent's apartment. Hoover and his crew publicly said they were right on Robinson's heels, and he believed them, especially when he read in the newspaper soon after his escape that his wife Frances and his father Thomas Sr. were both arrested and charged with aiding and abetting. Junior felt bad about this and tried to think up a way to meet up with his family to give them some of the ransom money to fund their defense, but he knew he would have a hell of a hard time getting anywhere near them.
Once he left the apartment, he drove to Springfield and rented a room and told the landlady that his car was leaking oil.
This was a rental car he never planned on returning.
And that he was going to Columbus with a friend to get a part to fix the car. He left the car in the garage. Well, a day or two later, she called the Springfield Police Department.
People around Springfield called in sightings, and the feds arrived and indeed found some of Thomas Jr.'s belongings in an apartment there.
He took a train from Springfield to Cleveland, I think, and he ran into somebody that he used to work for, and he reported the sighting to the Detroit office.
And this is how it went for weeks, and then months, and then a couple of years. Robinson Jr. was always a few steps ahead, though he had no idea how comfortable his lead would prove to be. If he had spent his money frugally and just set up house somewhere, all low-key like, he might never have been found. But that wasn't his style.
He bought all new clothes, nightwear, a tuxedo, so he could go out to all the fancy places.
He stayed in lavish hotels and flaunted his newfound money like some gaudy nouveau riche dum-dum. He hooked up with a girlfriend named Jean Breeze, who helped him blow through that $50,000, which, by the way, translates to nearly $1.2 million today. Not only did Jean spend the money freely, but a lot of her relatives got in on the action, too. Jean convinced Robinson that they were helping him launder the money to keep the feds at bay.
I think she was a little more hard-nosed than he was and knew the score and knew what she wanted, which was the money.
At one point, Robinson Jr. got his girlfriend to visit his parents' home. The feds didn't know to look for her, after all, and get them a message that he wanted to help with legal bills. They even managed a meeting with Robinson Sr., during which they sewed $500 into his clothing. But the elder Thomas got drunk on his way home and lost it all. Another time, he got $4,000 to his mother, but that was eventually strong-armed away from her by Jean Breeze. The trials against Robinson Sr. and Frances went forward while Jr. was on the lam. To Hoover's dismay, both were acquitted. The juries didn't believe the feds had proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they had been in on the scheme from the beginning. That left Thomas Jr. and Jean to live it up on the stolen money with clear consciences. But they were restless. Sometimes they'd live in New York for a spell, then they'd go to L.A. They would dry clean the money by shipping it to themselves via Western Union. They really could have gotten away with it all if they had just settled down and kept a low profile. But Thomas Jr. was getting increasingly paranoid as time went on, and Jean was finding herself less enamored with him. She had gotten pregnant at one point, and while she wanted to have the baby, he had convinced her to abort. How could we bring a child into the world we're living in, he argued. She never got over it. She started to turn on her lover. After Francis and Thomas Sr. were acquitted, Hoover was as furious as he was embarrassed. Here was this two-bit crook making him look a fool. He made sure Robinson's picture appeared in every publication possible, from daily newspapers to the Journal of the American Medical Association and the Masonic Home Journal. His photo was on most wanted posters in post offices and on flyers hanging in business windows. The pressure got so great that at one point, Thomas Jr. actually tried to turn himself in. It happened after then public enemy number one, Alvin Karpis, was arrested. With Karpis in cuffs, Thomas Jr. deduced that
he becomes public enemy number one. So he reads that and he gets nervous and he decides he's going to go to the FBI office and turn himself in. It's the Federal Building in Los Angeles. The FBI office is on the sixth floor. He's on the first floor. He talks to somebody, tells him, I'm public enemy number one. I want to turn myself in. The person didn't really understand him.
So he left. It didn't happen. But Jean Breeze was having similar thoughts. She knew how much the feds wanted her boyfriend, and she decided she would be the one to turn him in. She wasn't completely heartless about it. She specifically requested that he not be sent to Alcatraz, but she gave the feds the address of where they were staying and made sure that both she and her dog were out of there when agents arrived. The arrest on May 11, 1936 was anticlimactic. Thomas Jr. didn't even fight extradition. In fact, he didn't even have a trial. He pleaded guilty to avoid the death penalty, which was on the table as this was after the Lindbergh baby law went into effect. Bruno Hauptmann had just a month earlier been executed in Little Lindy's fatal kidnapping. By pleading guilty, Robinson surely figured he was avoiding the same fate. And he did, but soon regretted it. Maybe it was the harsh conditions at Alcatraz, where the Fed sent him despite Jean's pleas. He began studying the law again and put appeals into motion. In 1943, after 7 years in prison, a judge decided that Robinson hadn't been fully represented at his sentencing, so a trial was scheduled back in Louisville. If ever there were a case that perfectly illustrated the old adage, be careful what you wish for, this is it. The December 1943 trial was, in short, a disaster for Robinson. He claimed that he and Alice had been lovers, that she had left with him willingly, not to save her husband Barry, but because she wanted to be with him. Alice vehemently denied this on the stand. She was now 37 years old, reliving the most traumatic week of her life, not just for the courtroom, but for the world, as reporters were still very much interested in the case. She insisted there had been no consenting intimacy and no forced intimacy either. She said that if Robinson had molested her, quote, my husband would never stop until he had tracked him down and killed him, end quote. Robinson's defense lawyer tried to prove to the jury that Alice could have left the dingy apartment at any time. He had a partial replica made of the apartment's bathroom and showed there was a window in there, and even brought out a similarly sized woman in a kimono and heels to show she could have climbed through that window. It's worth noting that the stand-in bashed her head pretty badly escaping the replica window, so there was that. Plus, there was also the revelation that Thomas Jr. had gone to several other homes in the Stahl family before finding anyone at home to kidnap. That's how he landed on Alice. Robinson was convicted and sentenced to death. But his story didn't end there. The appeals were slow going and drawn out, but eventually, Robinson's lawyers convinced the U.S. Attorney General that Lindbergh's law, putting the death penalty on the table for kidnapping, shouldn't apply to cases where the victim was released without serious injury. And so his sentence was commuted to life in prison. After a return stint in Alcatraz, he was eventually transferred to lower security prisons from which he just walked away a couple of times. It's kind of wild that used to happen pretty regularly, but it did. Once he just wanted to visit his sick mom. Another time he tried to rob a pharmacy, but by then he was older and feeble and easily subdued. Both times he was rearrested and shipped back to prison. Finally, he was deemed not to be a threat anymore and was released in 1970 after serving 34 years in prison. And here's the part I find fascinating. After he was released, he and his wife, Frances, the woman he had roped into being an accomplice, albeit not a convicted one, got back together. They had never divorced, not through his cross-country gallivanting with Jean Breeze, not through his decades behind bars. They were still married when Frances died in 1985. Thomas lived until 1994. Alice Stahl outlived them all. By then a widow, Barry had died in 1983 at age 88. Alice died in 1996. She was 90 years old, and her obituary made a point to mention her brief stint in America's consciousness. To research this case, I read William Plunkett's book, The G-Men and the Heiress. Special thanks to Plunkett for sitting down for an interview with me and for sharing with me audio he found of the Reverend Eugene Arnold Clegg giving a press conference. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod. This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.